Hello, hello everyone. This is Alexandra Metters of GalacticConnection.com, and I am speaking to you live from South Africa. Today is October 14th, 2014, and as you all know, I have come out here to perform some very important tasks, one of them being some of the spiritual missions that I'm going on. And I continue to be called to go into certain areas. We've gone up to Zimbabwe, we're going to be doing some more work in South Africa, and our next stop is Botswana. In the meantime, through this journey, I have come across some fascinating people, and one of them I decided to pull on as my guest today, because I feel that what he has to share is something that is very near and dear to all of our hearts, and that is being able to create that magic, that connection between humanity and the nature and animal kingdom. He has probably one of the most kick-ass jobs you could ever imagine. He's going to talk to you a little bit about his desires to bring forth that spiritual connection with this wonderland in South Africa and be able to just open your eyes to some of the amazing things and opportunities that are here on this continent. So with that said, I'm going to go ahead and introduce you to Rupert Harris. And Rupert Harris has a business called Amber Felt Tours, and he is an amazing guy. The very first moment I met him, I knew that we were old souls and old friends, huh, Rupert?
Yes, thank you. Sounds amazing.
Yeah, it's just been incredible ever since I met you. Just the amount of information that you carry, the wisdom that you carry about the nature kingdom, I think this could just be something that all of us really desire when we're in that 8 to 5 or, 10-hour day grind, and we don't have that ability to really, really connect with the consciousness of nature. So I think what I'd like to do is just start off with, can you give them a little bit of an introduction? Because frankly, folks, this was a very on-the-fly interview today and a lot of technical problems again. So, Rupert, can you give us a little background on, where you come from, how long you've been here? I know you're a native South African, correct?
Yes, that's correct. Well, my mother is Afrikaans, and my father is second generation British. And I was born in Johannesburg, and we moved when I was a small baby. We moved to a town called Middelburg, where my father was a principal of a primary school. And I guess I grew up with my father's interest in nature, and specifically bugs and various kinds of interests, including birding. And somehow this just manifested in me. And my father died when I was quite young, but I maintained this ability or this interest into my life. And it just became a passion, specifically spiders, but of course other bugs as well. Just my love for getting out into the bush on a regular basis, or shall I say nature, where I would on a regular basis be hiking on weekends. And just the sense of being out there, which became, you could almost say, an absolute passion in my, basically a passion for wanting to do this over and over again, which then developed eventually by the late 90s into an interest in tour guiding. So I actually pursued a tour guiding career by doing a tour guiding course, and just developed from there. So from about 1998, I've been a tour guide in mainly this province, which is the Limpopo province, the most northerly province of South Africa, and the adjacent provinces, namely Mpumalanga and Gauteng. And my whole intention is to bring about a balance between having people experience the icon destinations of what South Africa has to offer with something different, namely, getting back into nature and having authentic natural or nature experiences.
Oh, that's fantastic. Now, you brought up the fact that you were introduced to the wonder world of bugs and spiders in particular. Now, that is arachnology?
That's correct, yes. Okay. It's, collectively, the eight leggeds in the bug world are collectively known as arachnids. Of course, different arachnids, there's scorpions, there's ticks, there's mites, they're all arachnids. But spiders being one of my main interests.
So why the spiders?
Well, it actually started with my father, believe it or not, who had a pet button spider, which is the equivalent of your black widow. And it was just interesting to watch this thing, catch insects that he used to put in the bottle for it. And I guess just from there, it was just this fascination that just developed into an understanding of, long-term interest in spiders. And the main thing about spiders is that it's a bottomless pit. I mean, if you compare the variations and the species diversification of spiders in South Africa to, for example, our mammal variety, it's just like night and day. It's chalk and cheese, basically. And so you get mesmerized for basically the rest of your life.
I was going to say, there's probably, hundreds of thousands of, it's got to be countless.
Absolutely. And, the other thing also about spiders is they're very understudied. So there's just this, great need for research regarding them. And not that spiders are, spiders are just part of the bigger picture than the nature picture, but it's just that once you get into them, it's just incredible to there's just this massive amount of information, a mesmerizing information that is available that is in many respects far, far more interesting than, for example, the African Big Five. Not that I'm running down the African Big Five at all, but I'm just saying that it's just this incredible reservoir of mesmerizing information that's available out there.
So it's almost like as if you're learning from their characteristics what makes the universe tick.
Yes, absolutely. And also... the mechanisms that keeps the whole process going. It's really of course they're all predators, but they serve a really important role in keeping the insect population down. And in fact, the insect population as such, I think, is tuned into the predation rates of spiders, amongst other.
Wow. I mean, and that I shouldn't be surprised at that, because of the brilliance of the nature kingdom,
yes.
Because it's automatically trying to maintain some sort of balance. And that's one of the questions I was going to ask you is,
yes.
Since you started this back in 1998, have you seen a radical change in the way in which maybe spiders and insects are operating?
Well, not as such in context with, changes on Earth as such, but certainly understanding how important they are in controlling insects, I would say yes. That realization process, that awareness, I would say on that level, yes. But not any specific changes pertaining to weather change or climate change or any of that, no.
Yeah, that, and let me clarify, too. I was thinking more in terms of all the toxicity, the chemtrails,
yes.
That sort of thing.
Oh.
How is that actually affecting the insect population? But if you haven't seen any radical changes, I'm just curious. I know they're fairly hardy.
Yes, they certainly are. You know, you can't come really. I would say certain insects, most certainly, insects that are very endemic to only certain parts of South Africa, and I'm sure in the States and other parts of the world, yes, those are most certainly affected, but not nearly on the level of, say, for example, frogs. Frogs seem to be on the decline from toxicity and also diseases, very weird fungal diseases that seem to be spreading through all parts of the world at the moment.
And it's fungal, which is interesting, isn't it? That goes back to cancer, you know?
Yes, no, absolutely. No, I would say spiders are, they seem to be very hardy, and it's also the way that they reproduce. They can actually fly. They use a system called ballooning, and they have this amazing ability to colonize with the minimum of use of energy from the moment they are actually they emerge from the egg sacs. They can actually balloon themselves up into the stratosphere. And they can reach parts of the globe which is done with a minimum of effort. Pretty much like plankton would float on the top of oceans. Mm-hmm. Spiders have the same ability. So I think that also counteracts the fact that they are on the decline. But I'm speaking under correction, of course. I haven't done official studies or anything on it. So.
Right, right. So what has been the most unique spider that you've actually, you know, encountered or do you capture them actually?
Yes, well what I do is when I if I come across something really interesting, I would capture it, and I would then post it to, I would take photographs, and then I would post it to a, believe it or not, a lady who's the top arachnologist in Africa, based in Pretoria,
right on,
Gauteng province. She would then identify it and then give me feedback, and I would learn out of that process. So I don't really have an extended collection of spiders. And what I also do is, if I come across spiders that I know, I usually leave them alone, because obviously I don't want to disturb their processes. So it's only when it's a spider that I've never, that I'm not sure of, that seems like a new species, then I would send it to her. And in terms of the most unique spider that I've come across, well, I don't know if anybody knows about the Ebola swinger. It's the most incredible spider. It's related to the orb web family of spiders. And what it does is it spins a very basic little single strand of web, and then it emits a pheromone which attracts male moths, and then it spins a web with a globule of glue on the end of it, and it actually bolus swings this as the moth approaches, smelling this female mimicking hormone. And it throws the bowler at the moth, which of course attaches to the moth, and it reels it in and grabs it. So there's the most amazing spider that you can imagine.
God, have you actually seen that?
I've seen one, but I've only seen it. They're very, very rare. I've actually seen one at this arachnologist lady's place in Pretoria, her lab. But I've been on the lookout for one throughout South Africa. So far, I haven't seen one, but I believe there was one captured about 60 kilometers from Polokwane, my hometown. So they are around, but they're very, very rare, and they're very elusive because they're kind of very well cryptically camouflaged.
That's so interesting. Now, what would you say, Rupert, to those of us that kind of get creeped out by spiders and, you know, what would you say to the person that says, you know, what are you doing that for? You know, why are you researching spiders, other than the fact that it's a passion of yours? What do you feel that this is for?
Well, I really believe that the movies, pretty much like snakes, I believe the movies have stigmatized spiders. So people are mind programmed into believing that all spiders are bad and they're out to get us. And that's absolutely not the truth. But of course, there are some spiders, I think, in every country, more so in other countries than other than some other countries, where the spiders, some spiders are of medical significance, and you just have to be cautious of them, and you just have to be basically vigilant. I think like your brown recluse spider,
yeah,
and your I think your black widow might be similar. We've got a couple of them here as well. That have a bad rep, and they in fact are known to cause, you know, serious problems. You know, there have been some deaths, but if you look at the ratio of deaths from spider bites, it's really, really minimal. So, and you'll also notice that most spiders just want to get away from you. So,
yeah,
they clearly have no intention or so bad intention towards humans. I think, if you just take it from that angle and start coming to that realization that spiders, in fact, there's a figure that I read, I think it was about 10 years ago, where they said the amount of insects that spiders eat, and that was 10 years ago. I think the population was around about, 6.5 billion?
Wow.
They say the amount of insects that the spiders eat on an annual basis equals the world human weight population.
Oh my God.
Weight of the human population. So, you know, just think of the benefit of that versus the fear factor of how many people actually die from spider bites or whatever, you know.
So they're such an essential part of maintaining, cleaning up the environment and keeping things at in a balance.
Absolutely. You know, I really think that they are of the most beneficial organisms on Earth, and also based on you know, how many individual spiders there actually are, without people even realizing it. I mean, I also read a figure once where in the normal savanna bush, for example, like where we have a bit of grassland and we have a little bit of trees. Per square meter, there would be something incredible, like something like 3,000 or 4,000individual specimens, just on in summer, of course, which is usually a lot of spiders are seasonal, just in a specific area. So you know, it's just this amazing. How can I say this amazing invisible. Assistance that is everywhere, and people should start coming to the realization of that and actually respecting it, I would say.
Well, good for you for stepping forward, because you know what? It is part of nature, and it isn't just about helping, as you say, the big five and all the larger
yes.
animals and the domestic
yes.
animals. It's all about, you know, Mother Earth's creations, period. So
yes.
it's another reason that I really wanted you to talk about it, because
yes.
you know, most of us are so creeped out about spiders yes. and snakes and things like that. I mean, some of us anyway.
Yeah.
But you know, I would pose that, you know, how many spider bite fatalities are there as compared to car fatalities?
Oh, absolutely. With, you know, there's almost no comparison. You know, and I mean, if I recall David Icke saying that more than 100 million people died in wars in the 20th century alone, which is just this unbelievable figure.
Something we should be not so proud of, that's for sure. And,
yes.
you know, I was going to ask you, too, I've never really studied spiders. I was curious, what do they typically eat?
Well, you know, any form of, well, the majority of them, I would say 98% of spiders consume insects. But, of course, bigger spiders or specialist feeders would be consuming crab-like crustaceans, possibly on the beach. You get some spiders that are specialized to live in the intertidal spiders, for example, that would be living on sand fleas. You get very large spiders that would be attacking vertebrates. I know that, for example, your spiders in the Amazon would basically overpower any animal that they can, including snakes, believe it or not. So, but that's just usually, as I said, you know, that would just be much your either your specialist feeders or your very large spiders that have just filled a specific ecological niche and are tapping into that food source. But the majority of them, 98%, I would say, certainly insects.
Now, doesn't the story go that in order for it to be classified as an official spider, it has to have 8 legs?
That's correct.
Okay.
Yes.
Versus what? Like, you know.
Well, insects, if you look at insects, they've got a head, a thorax, and an abdomen. They have antennae. They have 6 legs. And many insects have got a larval stage, which means they go through egg, worm-like larvae, pupa, and then adult stage. Whilst spiders just have an egg stage, spiderling stage, which is sort of underdeveloped in an egg sac, and then juvenile spider growing up into becoming a big spider, or adult spider.
Wow. And now, do they sleep?
No, not to my knowledge. It's very difficult to, I think, you see, they, all spiders, and in fact all vertebrates, I would say, have a much slower metabolism than mammals and birds. And I don't know the ins and outs of it, but to my knowledge, they can be very still and actually conserve energy. And I think that's got a lot to do with their brain capacity that determines whether they would need sleep or not. So most invertebrates, of course, except maybe octopuses, which have apparently the largest, the greatest intelligence of any invertebrate, to my knowledge, don't require the same sleep patterns as mammals would.
And you just mentioned that spiders actually have a brain?
Yes. In fact,
wow.
Yes, no, they most certainly have. In fact, on that note, I once read a very interesting article in National Geographic about a spider, which is Araneophagus. What that means, it actually only specializes in eating other spiders. And this happens to be a genus of the jumping spiders, those little short, stocky little spiders with the very large eyes in front. You often see photographs of them. They make very good photos. That actually, according to this article, has developed real intelligence in capturing its prey. What it normally does is it enters the web of a prey spider, and it mimics the vibratory entrance codes that the male will give on the web to ensure that the female doesn't actually consume him as prey. And this spider actually has, believe it or not, a repertoire of about 5 or 6 different species of prey, potential prey spiders, so that it knows exactly what vibratory movement to make entering a specific spider, a potential prey web. And the incredible thing is that if this doesn't work, then it abandons that strategy completely and then would actually approach the prey from a completely different angle, usually using a web and actually coming down and sneaking up to it. And it'll spend hours trying to catch its prey, and it'll eventually get its prey, and it'll block most of the moves that this prey actually makes in a way that is just hard to believe. And, you know, if you look at that whole process, you'll see that out of that is most certainly not instinct. There's certainly intelligence involved there. So, yes, and for that you obviously need a brain. So without a doubt, you know, and it's, of course, if you, anatomically, if you look at the you know, cross-section of spiders, there is most certainly a brain.
So anatomically, I mean, do they have, you know, like a basic heart chamber? You know, do they have like a nervous system of any sort?
Yes, yes. They've got a simpler nervous system, but most certainly they've got a brain, and then they've got this central nervous system that's right in the cephalothorax. In other words, the front part. As I mentioned earlier, spiders have two parts to them. There's the front part where their legs are attached to, and then the abdomen. And that's just known as the cephalothorax, which basically is the Latin for head and thorax together. So, yeah, the top part, closer just below the eyes, that's where you'd find the brain. And then there's the central nervous system.
You know, when you listen to someone like yourself who's this well-versed on, you know, a little spider that most of us don't even know it exists. I loved it when you said the invisible assistant.
Yes.
You know, how can you not believe that there is some sort of greater power out there that's creating such amazing creatures on this planet?
Yes.
And without them, you know, we would not be in a good place today.
I know. Without you know, without a doubt. You know, it's, I think it's a combination of this greater power with possibly with a plan, with an agenda, but I think there's also in that leeway for an evolutionary process. So I think it's actually a combination of the two. You know, if you look at specialization and if you look at how spiders have evolved for specialization. Just using spiders as an example, of course, all creatures for that matter. If you look at how they've evolved a specific specialization in their morphology. Without a doubt, there must have been some degree of evolutionary development to match a certain situation, because it's all about ecological niches. And it's about food sources, I would say. But, of course, survival in general. But how do you get a food? How do you get to your food source? And a giraffe is a very, very classic example. I mean, look at the size of a giraffe's neck.
Yeah.
Look at its incredible tongue. Look at how it can actually manipulate tiny leaves on an acacia tree that's got these vicious thorns. Just the whole design of a giraffe is, you can see that is that giraffe wasn't just placed there. It must have gone through some kind of a process to have been able to reach to that type of food, which the other animals couldn't reach or can't so effectively reach to. So I think the same process with spiders, and I think with everything for that matter.
You know, you're bringing up a good point too. I remember taking a herbology nature course.
Okay.
And we walked through this park, for lack of better words.
Yes.
And we were able to find various plants and even a few insects. And she was showing us how, you know, where there is a plant that might cause a rash or or stinging sort of feeling, within so many feet was another plant that provided the antidote to that provided the relief or the, you know, the cure for that particular effect to the body.
Yes.
And the same applies with nature, because if you look at a giraffe, you know, who else in a mammal, you know, from a mammal perspective, is going to feed off the tops of the trees?
Oh, no, absolutely. you know,
nature doesn't waste anything. You know what I'm saying?
No, absolutely. Look, it's you know, if you look at the food web, or, you know, the food chain, which is essentially a food web, because it's not just a chain link thing, it's more like a web. There's beauty out of harshness, because it's basically a vicious world out there, but somehow out of that is this harmony. And it's almost like there's this underlying intent in it. And maybe that's where the whole creator aspect comes into it. So it's just you, it's just about your understanding of the intent and the harmony that comes out of it.
Yeah, and being able to apply that to your own life. Now,
absolutely.
Now, getting back to the spider, I mean, do they travel, you know, do they kind of set up a territory and then they travel from that territory, or do they, you know, I'm just curious.
Well, there's not too much, there's, in certain spiders, especially the jumping spiders, there is actually some territorial display. But generally speaking, spiders, your wandering spiders actually can travel large distances. And they would gravitate to where there would be more of an abundance of food. For example, you'll find certain wolf spiders, certain sac spiders, certain armored ground spiders, referring now to South African spiders, that you would find in leaf litter in the forest, where there's an abundance of insect larvae, crustaceans, isopods, all kinds of things hanging out. The spider would then, you would find a greater concentration of spiders there simply because there's a greater concentration of food. So I think it really depends entirely on the availability of food. And I do think that a lot of spiders can in fact migrate to greener pastures as such to find the food. So I think it's really mainly about the food factor. And then of course the reproduction. You know, where there would be availability of females. Male spiders would wander in research of the scent of the female, because that's primarily their reproductive drive force, I guess.
Really? They use like a scent?
Yes. No, absolutely. Spiders are very, very... their whole system is actually... designed, or shall I say, evolved around pheromones, airborne pheromones. But then again, so are a lot of other animals, a lot of insects, a lot of different creatures, in fact.
It's just that we would never think of spiders to operate off of that.
Yes.
It would be like the first thing you'd think, you know?
Absolutely. Because one thing that I can say is that, well, the majority of spiders don't have three-dimensional vision, except for your jumping spiders. So you would have, they obviously certainly won't rely on sight to look for a mate. And they also won't rely on hearing or any of that kind of thing. So it is definitely scent-related. Without a doubt. So obviously they'll gravitate to an area where there's an abundance of females, for example, because it's usually the male. Now it's only the male that would tie in and then actually pursue the female, not vice versa.
Now, I heard somewhere that insects, I remember reading this when there was a survival manual floating around,
yes.
And they said that the insects actually have a very large percentage of water. And is that where the spider is actually, able to access its own water supply?
Yes. in times of abundance, spiders don't drink. So they would consume or they would obtain all their moisture from their prey. But I have actually witnessed spiders in laboratories, and I've actually kept spiders that would also drink from available water that gets given to them. So it's, it works both ways. It just depends on the circumstances. But spiders also don't sweat, and they don't need, certainly don't need nearly as much moisture as what mammals do. they'd have to cool themselves the whole time. Specifically, horses as an example, that sweat quite profusely. So yes, it depends, I think it just depends entirely on the circumstances that determines what the needs of the spiders are.
Now, you also mentioned, that the spider that actually ballooned itself into the air.
Yes. Well, spider web, relative to its aperture, its thickness, is incredibly strong and incredibly elastic. There's been some people that have made, scientists that have made comparisons with, web being, in other words, silk, being stronger than steel for its weight and for its thickness. And of course being very elastic. So what happens is that these little spiderlings actually get to a high point once they've come out of the egg case, or once they've actually matured enough out of the egg case, and ready to move off. They would climb to a high point, and then they would let off a number of silk strands from their spinnerets that would be almost invisible to us. And being so strong, they would then they would release, say, for example, a half a meter silk strand, or three or four silk strands simultaneously with the abdomen up in the air. And a bit of wind would catch this, and then the spider would just release itself, and it would actually become like a parachute. And it would actually fly up. And here's the other amazing thing, is that a lot of spiders have antifreeze properties in their blood. So when they get to these extremely high heights, they would actually go into almost a state of suspended animation. And that is an incredible adaptation.
Wow.
For them to actually survive. Yes, it's quite something.
And think of what we can learn just by studying them. I just knew when I spoke to you that I would just be fascinated when I interviewed you.
Yeah. Well, I was telling you this, what I read the other day. It's actually a little bit scary, but it's we talk about GM foods, and we talk about all kinds of different genes being infused into our food and what. But what I read once is that they now have taken spider genes, and they've infused it into goats. I think it's the embryo of the goat. And what this goat does is it actually produces milk. And the milk actually contains the spider silk protein, which gets isolated. And out of that they make a fabric. And apparently this fabric has the most incredible properties. I haven't seen this fabric. It's just something that I've heard. And I actually need to try and get some more details on this, but spider silk is supposed to have the most incredible properties of any organic substance, in terms of strength and in terms of flexibility, in terms of elasticity.
This is
one way that they obtain it, apparently.
I was going to say, Rupert, I think that even goes back to thousands of years ago in the Asians.
Yes.
Did it not? So where they actually kept the spiders.
Yes. yes.
Well, that was very interesting. Now, the other thing I'm so curious. Most spiders are very solitary, and I was wondering, do they act at times, depending on their species? Do they act like, say, a colony of ants?
Well, that's really fascinating. if you go to Kruger National Park.
Which I did. And I loved it.
It's an amazing place. There's one species of spider. The generic name is Stegodyphus, and they are community spiders. And unlike most spiders, which are actually in most cases opportunistic cannibals, these actually live together as a colony. They don't actually have a queen, so it's not really truly a social structure where you have an alpha male and alpha female breeding as in bees or in termites. And by the way, termites are not ants at all. but I'll get back to that a little later.
Oh, yeah, I'd like to.
But these spiders actually just live together, and there would be anything up to 300 individuals in a large nest. And they collectively spin a web, and they collectively capture prey to the benefit of everyone. So I would say those are the only true social spiders that collaborate together. The rest would be semi-social. You get some species. We've got a very large golden warbeb spider that occurs usually in April. That's our autumn period. They get really large, large enough, in fact, to even on occasions catch a small bird in their web.
No,
but yeah, but very, very seldom. It's mainly insects. They would collaborate. They wouldn't actually be social, but they would build a web one on top of each other. And I think that's also an evolutionary trait where most likely it pushes everybody's chances up of getting prey, because if an insect flies in there, there's a chance that it's going to fall into somebody's web. So I think that's purely just a evolutionary trait. But for the rest, I would say, and from my experience, spiders are very opportunistically cannibalistic. So it's really pretty much like, pretty much like a leopard, a African leopard. African leopard would eat anything that it can overpower, whether it's a predator, whether it's, except maybe another leopard, of course. So they're not really cannibalistic, but they will try and overpower anything that they can. Predator or herbivore, doesn't really matter. The same could be said of spiders, because it's just basically a food source.
And you would never think that a spider would act actually in a communal level where it's sharing its prey, you know, its catch.
Yes, no, it's a very unique spider that. As I said, you know, in terms of the efficiency of having an alpha male and female where the others are basically workers, where the others assist the alpha male and female to be successful as a breeder and also for genetic selection, purposes, that system doesn't exist there, but, certainly in terms of prey capture, without a doubt. And probably also, you know, safety in numbers. I think if you can build a very large collective nest, because there are a lot of predators of spiders as well. That's what a lot of people don't realize. Spiders, in fact, are a food source for a huge amount of birds, wasps, parasitic wasps, wasps that sting spiders and paralyze them but don't kill them, lay the eggs on them, the larva comes out, gradually internally consumes the spider. Very horrific. I don't know if anybody's seen the movie Alien. Well, there's a good example of the movie Alien. I think that's where they got the author, I think, got his ideas from insect parasitism. So spiders themselves have got lots of you know, the enemies. So I would say, in terms of community spiders, that's probably one of the other benefits, is that it actually they have safety in numbers, pretty much like sardines.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, is it true that their color represents their danger, like, you know, the reds,
yes,
oranges, and yellows?
Well, not so much in spiders. Because spiders, generally speaking, use their venom to overcome their prey, depending on the way that they catch their venom, their prey. But what you're referring to is opposed to somatic coloration, where an animal would be poisonous for whatever reason. Let's say, for example, an arrow-poisoned frog from the Amazon would have these glands in its skin, mm-hmm, and it's deadly, deadly poisonous. And you'd have a beetle in South Africa called, say, I'm just thinking of an example, a blister beetle. And likewise, if you pop that beetle in your mouth, Not that you want to do it. I'm just referring to a predator. the chances are that you're going to die. And the one is a beetle and the other is a frog, which is amazing. They call that convergent evolution. It's like tapping into this particular formula where a frog and a beetle are not related whatsoever. And yet they employ the same system, posismatic coloration. Well, that doesn't exist in spiders, to my knowledge. It's more about just that spider happens to have, by pure coincidence, that ability to overcome its prey, like as in the Black Widow, as in our South African button spider, which is the equivalent of the Black Widow, where it just uses neurotoxic venom to immobilize its prey quickly after wrapping its prey in silk. And usually it's the jaws are very, very small. There's no particular, any other particular significance to it. In fact, they're both very shy spiders. So it's only when you press your body against the spider that's actually going to retaliate and bite you. So I would say that's it's got primarily to do with just the spider's particular hunting habits or snaring habits. That determines how powerful the venom actually is.
Wow. Now, are there any spiders in Africa that are just deadly, you know, if you get a spider bite?
Yes, well, I do spider talks for different people. I've got a PowerPoint presentation. And that is the most commonly common questions I get is what spiders are venomous and what spiders are not. We have, I would say, three or four spiders here in South Africa, which you could say are venomous, medically important spiders. But I wouldn't say that any of them are so deadly that, you know, you on the level of a diamondback rattlesnake or an African mamba, where the spider bites you, you're in that kind of trouble. You've got time on your hands. And the deaths, generally speaking, are very rare from spider bites. Usually the people that are that die from it are usually elderly people or children that are very young or somebody that has some kind of a medical condition. For example, very bad diabetes, circulation, heart trouble, that kind of thing.
Where they've overwhelmed the immune system to the point where the body just can't fight off the infection or the toxin.
Yes, well, that's usually what happens. You know, we've got a number of spiders. We've got a spider called the violent spider, which is the closest relative to your brown recluse, which has a very nasty venom. There's an enzyme in it that just continues basically. Dissolving the flesh.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's as bad as your brown recluse, for example, but it's certainly very significant in terms of the time that it takes for you to overcome the wound and the fact that most people or a lot of the victims would probably have to even go for plastic surgery at a later stage, things like that. But not to the point where it's a killer.
Right. I'm sorry. I just wanted to comment on the brown recluse for those of you out of the United States. There's such a ton of very fearful articles about the brown recluse, and there have been quite a few people that have been bitten by them. But I have a story, and I can speak from absolute testimony to this. I was living next to a guy who somehow or another, he crawled into a very old bird of paradise tree, and he decided one day he was going to cut it down and prune it. And this tree was probably, you know, 50 years old. Okay. So, it had probably a lot of nests in it. And he decided one day to, you know, just really go for it. And the next thing he knew, he woke up and he had these bites, and he had a fever, and, you know, he started having all these, all these, it would start out kind of with a blister, and then it, you know, the skin started swelling, and there was incredible pain, and, you know, all kinds of stuff. And what I found, my husband actually came over to my house after he found out he'd been bitten 38 times.
Oh, God.
Okay, by these brown recluse. And he had gone into a clinic, and they basically said to him, you know, we really can't help you unless you have an example of the spider that bit you. But what we can tell you is that, you know, you have a lot of toxins in your bloodstream, et cetera, et cetera. And they gave him some sort of pill, and they sent him home. Okay? But, of course, as you know, the enzyme continues to keep working.
That's right.
By chipping away and eating the flesh.
Yeah.
So I just intuitively followed my, you know, my guidance. And one thing I want to tell everybody is, one of the greatest things you can have on hand for any spider bite, I might add, is a particular form of clay. And the one that I used was the Indian healing clay. It's got incredible properties.
Wow.
And I mixed it with organic apple cider vinegar, which stung a little bit, but it was worth it because you know the benefits of apple cider vinegar.
Yeah, amazing.
And I used that. I used colloidal silver. I also, after I applied the clay and let it sit so that we could continue to draw the toxins out of, the, you know, topically out of the skin.
Wow.
And I just kept doing that. And I actually let it sit on there longer than they would recommend and wrapped it in cellophane, each part of his body. And I did that several times a day. I was dosing him with very high, you know, high amounts of oregano leaf and grapefruit seed extract, which are extremely excellent for your immune system because the immune system is, as you can imagine, very overwhelmed. And it was very successful. I mean, seriously, within about 2 to 3 days, not only did he not have a temperature, the pain subsided substantially, and the flesh stopped being eaten away.
Fantastic.
So yeah. I just want everybody to know that, you know, we keep hearing all this fear porn, you know, and I really want to bring up Ebola before I forget. I forgot to ask the last gentleman I interviewed here, what is your take on the Ebola virus? There's been so much fear mongering about it in the news, especially on the west side of you know, throughout Europe and the United States. We're all freaking out about Africa, you know. What's coming out of Africa? What is your opinion on that?
Well, I'm not sure what to think about the origins of Ebola.
Yeah.
I've read some... Well, first of all, you know, one has to bear in mind that Congo, the central part of Africa, is a huge, it's a huge country, and there's a lot of inaccessible areas there. And there's possibly a lot of endemism with, shall I say, coexistences or coexistence scenario between species and prey. Species and diseases. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's also the big apes that live there. You've got your chimpanzees and you've got your gorillas and you've got all kinds of old world monkeys. And they are pretty close to us in terms of evolution, or shall I say in terms of DNA. But of course, that's also something that I think people, you know, that requires a lot more research because there's a lot of new information coming out about that. But what is possible is that there could have been a disease there that jumped the species barrier, given the fact that we are so close to, you know, the big apes, the great apes. It could be that, or it could be that it is in fact a manufactured or a mutated version, deliberately mutated version of one of these diseases that were set free for some other specific agenda. What I do think is that what I do suspect is that it is possibly part of some other campaign first of all, to create fear, but also to initiate a whole vaccine, immunization vaccine campaign on humans that has probably something sinister to it.
I agree.
Yes. And the thing is that it is actually it's kind of a catch-22 scenario because it's really, from what I can gather, the little bit that I've read about it, it's really, really a serious disease. So it's not something that should be taken lightly. And I do agree that if there are, you know, given the fact that it's such an incredibly contagious disease, that it should measures should be taken to contain it. I believe South Africa's stopped flights to Liberia, for example.
And yeah, I think Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Namibia, yes. Right?
That's right. Yeah. So at least that's a positive thing, and I believe we sort of gearing ourselves up for a possible Ebola outbreak here. I think that one should just be as open-minded about it as possible. And I think that really what's important is not to focus only on the mainstream media and what's going on with the mainstream media. One should actually be very, very balanced in receiving information from the alternative, even though it sounds far-fetched or over the top. I think one should actually apply discretion as far as possible and be as vigilant as possible, because it really is a very, very serious disease. There is virtually no cure. I believe 90%, 95% of people, somewhere around there, even more, don't make it when they get it. And if I'm not mistaken, is it airborne disease?
Yes. And in fact, I wanted to just add a couple things that I've read.
Yes.
So the first one is that they are determining that you actually have to have some sort of mucus exchange, or, you know, somebody sneezing on you.
Okay.
That it spread through some sort of kind of wet contact, you know, like kissing.
Or micro droplets.
Right. Like body.
Right.
Tissue. Okay. So that's the first thing. And the second thing I've been told is that there have been a few articles that have stated that if you are able to get your hands on the very high parts per million colloidal silver and extremely high quantities of vitamin C, that they have shown that that's been very effective.
Wow.
So that's another thing I've read. And then the last thing I've read is that I think there have been some military officials that have stepped forward. They've even admitted that they're spraying these in the chemtrails. So, you know, again, it is one of those classic situations where the powers that were are in a state of desperation. They're trying like heck to get everybody, you know, to think that they're not safe.
Yes.
And what I just want to say to everybody is, you know, it hasn't worked before and it's not going to work now. I mean, I say this and I'm going to state this again, and that is, if we truly did not have galactic assistance as well as, you know, godly assistance, we would have across the world been inundated with plagues. I mean, literally, with the amount of garbage that they've been spraying in the air over and over and over again in the last couple of decades, especially. I know they've started way back, you know, from what I've read, they started back in even the 70s, and some have even reported the 50s. But, you know, we are in a situation where we have so much more support. And if everything is really, truly based on a virus, this too will pass. And it's just another, you know, I just really want to put that out there. So for all of you that are hearing it, because I've had a few emails, people saying, wow, you're in South Africa, you know, are you worried about the Ebola, blah, blah, blah. And I'm not. And the other thing I wanted to ask you about was the HIV, because a lot of people have questions about that. Can you give us a little bit of background on what you know as to how that's affected, you know, Africa? How serious is it? You know, what are you hearing today as far as the impact on this continent?
Yes, it's been very well, based on the information that you receive from the mainstream media, it seems as if it's been it has had a massive impact on certainly Southern Africa. There was a stage where it was estimated that something like one out of every four people have been affected by HIV, or that actually are HIV positive in this part of the world. And what I've seen here amongst the local populations is that it's become taboo to actually talk about AIDS, having AIDS or having HIV. And it's quite convenient because you don't die of AIDS. You don't die of HIV.
I agree.
You actually die of other diseases because your immune system, your T helper cell has been compromised, or it's been disabled, which means that your whole immune system, essentially speaking, has been disabled. So when somebody speaks about somebody that's passed, they will tell you, well, he died of tuberculosis, or he died of a really serious flu, or something like that. But I had a gardener who worked for me, and he one day started getting ill. And I have to tell you, it was not a pretty picture. I mean, his teeth was falling out. He had an incredible smell to him. It seemed like he had a constant stomach disorder.
Yeah.
It's really, I personally seen the effects of it, and the trouble is with it is that it's very dynamic, because the window period from the time that you acquire the virus seems to be dynamic as well. That seems to change. So the way it affects people is just so incredible. You would find that somebody, of course, we've got a very high rate of promiscuity in South Africa, because culturally speaking, a lot of the people around here are still in the mode of, what is the right word, polygamy.
Mm.
So there's this polygamy overtone that's still happening amongst the folks. And we've got a lot of, families that are broken up, because most of the work, most of the employment is available in the large centers. If you go to the tribal areas where people live, you usually find that the breadwinner of the family, which is the man, is not available. He's working in a large center, like, for example, Johannesburg, or in a center like Polokwane, where I am. He's away. Most of the time he's away, and he's just, what are they doing? They're really surviving. And already he has a large family, but in the meantime, he's actually got another family because he's got a mistress.
Mm.
But he has mistresses. And I think with the combination of the lack of education, I think that HIV has just spread its wings like you cannot believe. But there is now, I see, educational campaigns to make people become aware of it. And I think there's that the new generation is, if you want to call it, condomizing on a regular basis, and actually becoming a lot more faithful to say one partner. So I think things are changing. The tides have turned, so to say. I don't get the sense that there's this huge rate of infection as in the past. And just am hoping that it is something that is going to eventually perpetuate itself and manifest itself. But I certainly still think that a large portion of the population are HIV positive. The other thing I'm also getting the sense is that many people are not getting, or they, it seems as if the resistance in humans here, specifically in this part of the world, seem to be changing as well. So people are not dying as quick as what they used to in the past. So maybe it's kind of a co-evolution process that's happening at the moment. I'm not sure.
I actually really agree with that, especially yes. from a practitioner standpoint, that yes. the body is so absolutely brilliant that yeah. if we continue to get bombarded with all of this garbage, all this yes. bio, you know, I hate to say it, but literally this bio warfare that our own government have used against the people of the world.
Yes.
Thank God we have this brilliant mechanism that we call our body that is yes. so brilliant that it is creating ways in which to fight off these very bizarre, very mutated types of viruses and funguses, etc. And,
yes.
you know, from what I've studied regarding HIV, there are, there have been very successful people out there that have been able to assist and bring it to a halt.
Yes. No, I totally agree. There is just one problem about South Africa. South Africa is also very big on genetically modified foods.
Mm.
And I think that that combined with the fact that we're quite an industrial country, if you compare us to the rest of Southern Africa, I think that the quality of our nutrition also probably plays a role in making us or keeping us sick.
Yeah.
And I think that's one avenue that that needs to be addressed in terms of awareness. I think people need to be made more aware of proper eating. Proper nutrition, but it's a catch 22, because when you want to buy, you see the trouble with South Africa, just using South Africa as an example, is that more than 50% of the people here don't contribute to the economy at all, because they're just below the point where they pay tax, or we've got an unemployment rate, I think official unemployment rate is something like 25%, somewhere around there, it keeps changing.
Right.
You compare that to Europe and you compare that to the United States, it's horrific. So what are these people, how do these people survive? Well, they buy cheap food. And that cheap food is basically, it's basically genetically modified, highly processed food.
And
that keeps them in the box.
It's so, gosh, I'm so glad you brought this up because that has been a big aha since I got here.
Yes.
One thing I do want to say is, first of all, when you look at the amount of unemployment per country,
yes.
we typically can only count on the delivery of statistics by the government agencies. So this
right.
is a problem because I really feel like they're underreporting the true.
Totally agree with you.
Yeah, they're totally underreporting the true nature of what's going on in the planet.
Yes.
I think that, you know, I am really going to go out on a limb here and say that in the United States, I mean, seriously, we've sat around the coffee table and talked about this, you know, my friends at home, and we all really believe we're looking probably more at like 35% to 40% of the people are unemployed. And even if they are employed, they're manipulating the stats so that it looks like, you know, things are so much better than they are because the majority
yes.
of the people can only get a part-time job. And
yes.
here they've had, you know, 4 to 6 to 8 to even 12 years of education in universities.
Yes.
And they can only get a job for $10 an hour.
Wow.
So, you know, the United States is really, you know, we are targeted in a different sort of way. I think we're exceptionally targeted with the HARP, the surveillance, the frequency waves, that sort of thing. There's no question when I got here how radically different it is to be here regarding the frequencies in your air compared to the United States. However, what I noticed about being here is the type of food, and that there's so much GMO food here. It's the standard operating procedure to go into a grocery store, and that's pretty much all you choose from. And I was appalled that the majority of the South African blacks are primarily eating maize meal, I think is what you call it.
That's correct,
And, you know, that is like one of the number one GMO foods.
Without a doubt.
Planet, you know?
Without a doubt.
And they eat that for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. They put meat in it. They make it sweet in the morning, you know. And I'm thinking to myself, oh, my God, there we go again, you know. So this is in Africa.
Without a doubt. The other thing is that if you look at most of their lifestyle, especially in the tribal areas, you'll see that there's no intention to go anything beyond very, very basic subsistence, the growing of subsistence crops. Most of the people have a small stand, and they would grow a seasonal bunch of corn stalks, and they would harvest them, and that's about as far as they would go. So for the balance, it would just be this total reliance on bought foods from a supermarket. And the other thing that I've also noticed is that wherever you go into these tribal areas, you start seeing these large corporate malls, if you want to call them corporate malls, going up. So it's a vicious circle. They're making dead sure that these people are going to, and you know, have this convenience of buying cheap genetically modified foods right on their doorstep, so to say, in comparison to the past. So it's all, I think, part of a campaign to ensure that the vicious circle remains a vicious circle.
Oh, I agree. I think the other thing is they're being specifically targeted for the fact that they're one of the few remaining places on the planet that they really are in touch with Mother Earth. They walk around barefoot. They're oftentimes in the bush or in the forest. Most of the jobs around here, anyway, are logging and cutting down trees, you know, the farm trees. And, you know, apparently some of them don't even, a lot of them don't have electricity. They work off of a fire if they want to keep something up. And they sleep in these round huts with dirt floors. So it's a completely different environment. And the cool thing is, I find them to be, at least in this location, I find them to be just absolutely beautiful in their purity of essence. You know, they're singing, you know, they're smiling, they're laughing. You know, they haven't gotten lured into that whole 3D materialistic mode of operation. They're just perfectly happy with the fact that they just have a meal. And unfortunately, you know, the powers that be have taken advantage of that core aspect of them.
Yes. Well, dare I say this, that it's actually changing quite radically, because you can go to the most remote parts of that area where you're staying at the moment, which is Venda. You can go right into the mountains there. That's the most northeastern part of South Africa. There's a tribal group there called the Venda. And you can drive some really bad roads, and you can get right into the mountains, and you'll find a hut, and you'll actually find a satellite dish on that hut. So that suggests to me that the values, unfortunately, are changing fast, because that person or that family now has access to those specific values that are probably on a subliminal level being projected to him or her, and changing their values very, very fast. And it's quite tragic to watch it. But in the sense of, I was in Guyana, South America, in 2004, and I was expecting to find some really ethnical Amerindian people there. And what I saw there was just basically, far more removed from what we are here, in the sense that most of the Amerindian people actually had surnames like Simon, just regular European-style surnames, anglicized surnames. And they just lost their language, they'd lost every aspect of their being. And at least in South Africa, that is not the case yet. But my sense is that it's actually changing very fast. And you can clearly see there's a campaign to pull everybody into line, if you want to call it that.
Yeah, and get them all away from their own cultures and ways of working together as a team.
Yes.
Well, back to the trips that you do and the tours that you have put together.
Yes.
Not to segue back away from Ebola and HIV, but one of the main things I just really want people to hear about is your experiences out in the bush and out in the jungles and that kind of thing. And literally, when I first met Rupert and he started telling me some of his experiences, my jaw was on the floor. Just this is the type of National Geographic Sunday night shows that I grew up watching with my parents, the description that you've gone through. So what I'd like to do is I find that the discussion on spiders really opens up the door to not taking one creature for granted as far as their importance. And when I first met Rupert, when I first got here, I was a little freaked out about the snakes. And so I was wondering if you could tell everybody a little bit about the snakes and your experience with them.
Well, I'm a hiker. I'm a hiker out of passion. So I'm very, very, as often as I can, I do walks. And I walk in the bush. When I say the bush, I walk in nature. I try in sort of wilderness areas. And I've been doing this for probably, let me just think, a good part of 45 years of my life.
And Rupert, when you say 45 years of your life, clarify for the audience what walking in the bush really means. Because now that I'm here, I really have a whole new appreciation for it.
Yes. Well, to give you an example, around our area where I live, you can go in any direction in a radius of about 130 kilometers, and you'll come across a nature area or a proclaimed wilderness area with incredible variation from forests to Kalahari type desert to savanna to something like Kruger National Park, which is a combination of savanna, a bush, which is with riverine forest, with different ecozones. And I actually very often go walking on my own, just me and my dog. And I can, in those 45 years of walking, I can maybe count on my right fingers the fairly scary, significant snake experiences I've had. And I'm talking like hundreds of hikes. So, we've got some pretty bad snakes around here in terms of the venom. We've got, for example, the puff adder, which is equivalent of the diamondback rattlesnake. It's a very common snake. It's a very cryptically camouflaged snake. They're very sluggish. You are in quite serious trouble if it bites you. They're also basically vipers. We've got Mozambican spitting cobras, which can spit venom into your eyes. We've got the black mamba, which probably gives you something like 20 minutes to live if it bites you, because it's got a cardiotoxic venom. These are all really scary snakes. But this is my point. I've been hiking for probably, as I said, 45 years, 40 years, let's say 40 years, you know, of my life, where I've had encounters with really bad snakes, including this black mamba that I've mentioned. And you can go and Google the black mamba. It's a very serious snake. And yes, my heart nearly jumped out of my cage because this thing reared up 4 feet in front of me. It could have bitten me in the face.
God.
I was alone on top of a mountain. If it had bitten me, I would have probably have not made it down the mountain. But it looked at me. It simply waited for me to make the next move. It was basically, I startled it and it startled me. We looked at each other. I stepped back. Snake also moved off in the opposite direction at one incredibly fast speed because it's one of the fastest snakes in the world. And that was it. And we just parted ways. I've actually had non-poisonous snakes even fall on me and just want to get away from me as quick as possible. So I really think that there's this hype, and it really is a hype. I think that the movies, the media hypes up the whole snake thing. And I think that is really, from what I've been speaking to a lot of Americans about your rattlesnakes as well, there's really this hype about snakes. And I think what it actually does is this hype is designed to keep us away from connecting with Mother Earth, with Mother Gaia Earth. I really believe it's actually a campaign to try and minimize our the time that we actually spend. It's a fear factor.
Yeah.
It's a fear. It's designed as a fear factor for you to not to connect with Mother Earth. And I really think that one just needs to start changing that attitude.
Well, and the fact that it's almost like when you explained that circumstance, when you came upon that black mamba.
Yes.
What immediately hit me was it had a consciousness. It actually gave you an opportunity to back away.
Absolutely.
And it looked you right in the eye. I mean, that just blew my mind.
Absolutely. Look, snakes are predators. They have venom to protect themselves, obviously from to defend themselves. But the snakes that do have venom, and remember there are many, many snakes. In fact, there's 138 species of snake in South Africa. I think it's about 138. Might be a bit wrong. But only 15 of them are actually significantly venomous. But why would they be significantly venomous? Is it because we are the prey? No. It's simply because we are potentially the adversary that wants to do them harm, and they might want to protect themselves, but we certainly aren't a prey item. So clearly the snake is just there to protect itself. But I really think, yes.
That's a great point. I love that. That's such a great perspective.
Yes. But I can't emphasize, you know, I look at a lot of people around here, a lot of our black South African population. There's this taboo about snakes, and I think it stems from basically their shamanistic background. But I think that has been blown out of proportion by the media and by the movies to the point where it is an absolute no-no. I know a lot of people that would say to me, I will never, never, ever go hiking on my own. I will never, in other words, I will never really on a regular basis connect with Mother Gaia Earth, okay, because of my fear of snakes. So I really think it's very significant, and I really think that's something that has to be worked upon by people. I think it's that's something that people really have to become made aware of, actually how amazing snakes are.
Well, and you also brought up another point, which is fear is a vibration. And the animal kingdom and the reptiles and, you know, they all work off of a vibratory sensation.
Yes.
And so, you know, I've done a ton of hiking as well, and I've literally hiked right through rattlesnake dens. And never once have I even come across one. In fact, when we did hear a couple, they were rattling, basically saying, hey, get out of my space.
Yes.
You know, they were warning us to back off. And I often compare this to the body, you know, because I'm often a nurse practitioner and I work with things like that. And I remind people that the body is doing the same thing. It walls off what it perceives to be the enemy or the toxin or the infection or the virus, whatever. It walls it off, creates a tumor or a cyst or whatever, and it's doing this to protect you and save you. It's not, you know, like we look at, oh my God, I have a tumor. Instead of saying, well, thank you, body, for protecting me from that.
Yes.
You know, we're looking at it like, oh my God, we got to cut it out.
Yes.
And it's all in the way that you perceive it. You know, your body is your friend, and even if it's creating very contorted, funky things in your body, it's doing it very, very efficiently in many cases to stave off infection and an overwhelm to the immune system.
Well, I've never thought of it that way. And you know what it reminds me of is the way that a pill is actually formed.
Yeah.
In an oyster. It works exactly in the same principle.
Yeah.
It's an irritation, and it's just this, this covering around the irritation that just perpetuates. It carries on and on and on and eventually becomes a pill.
Well, and think about it. Something beautiful comes out of that, right?
So, yes.
You know, if we don't start changing our way of thinking, because we are creators, and we need to accept the fact that the game is over for the dark.
Yes.
We are the ones creating the new reality. We're doing it right this minute.
Yeah.
Now, it's game over. The light has completely penetrated the planet. Yes, there's still some stuff that needs to get done, but the short of it is, the moment you make that decision that you are a creator and you're not going to create what they want you to create, that's really what all this is all about, fearing the snakes, freaking out over spiders, and I'm guilty of it too, you know, being freaked out about going out to your backyard because you might get bitten. It's all been a program. It's a program to keep us separated from that which really makes us whole, and that is our mother.
Absolutely. You know, of all my experiences in my life, my most memorable experiences are my wilderness traveling experiences and my hikes. Those are the things that actually stick in my mind. It's almost like somebody having a turbocharged Ferrari and saying, well, of all the things in my life, that was the most profound experience, was actually owning, having that vehicle, owning it and driving it. Well, that is my experience with nature. You know, my life, my experiences of hiking and being in nature, those are the most memorable in my life. Those are the most significant memories that I actually, that stick in my life. And, it's just something that doesn't stop. I just need to get back. I need to be in nature. I need to continuously be back to continue that process. That's, for me, it's an absolute connection. And I think now, just imagine somebody that's got a fear of snakes. Let's say a really bad phobia of snakes will automatically never ever be subject to nature. And I really think that is such an effective, and let me say this much, there are just millions of people, well, I don't know about in the States or Europe or whatever, I think in Europe as well, because my wife is from Holland and I've spoken to a lot of people there that seem to have a fear of it, but certainly around here there are just millions and millions of people in that frame of mind. Mm-hmm. And something, you know, something needs to be done about it.
That's a very good point. Well, that's why I'm pulling you on the show, because it's time for us to take back our power and be in the driving seat of how we really want to live our life cohabitating with our planet. It's like,
that's right.
you know, coming here in South Africa has been such a blessing. First of all, just, I took a walk. Okay, when I first got here and I heard about all the snakes, granted, I was a little bit, wow. You know, like, wow. Yeah, okay, be. That's mamba that's going to, you know, you're dead in 20 minutes. But then I started thinking about it, and I love to hike up stuff. And I thought, well, you know what? I'll just stay on the dirt road.
Yes.
And there's a lot of them around here.
Yes.
And, you know, I just got rid of the fear. I just called in some protection, and I went for it. It was the most incredible experience of my life. I've been doing it, like, as many days out of the week as I can and take a hike around here.
Yes.
One of the things I'm absolutely blown away by is just the number of butterflies. I mean, I have seen, just in one walk, I saw about 13 different species.
Yes. We have, generally speaking, we have an amazing variety of insects in South Africa, just different parts of South Africa, because there are just so many different habitats in South Africa. But the mountain range that you're living in at the moment has more plant species growing on it than the whole of Canada.
Wow.
Yes. So if you have more plant species there, then clearly you're going to have, it's going to support a huge insect population, amongst them, of course, butterflies. And the area that you're in at the moment is also temperate rainforest. So the rainfall is pretty high compared to the surrounds.
Yeah.
So it's conducive to a high insect and, of course, butterfly population. And really beautiful. And it's known, internationally known as a butterfly hotspot.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes.
I mean, they're brilliant. Like, there's lavenders and turquoises and peaches and oranges. And I mean, I've never seen such incredible. And they come up and they land right in front of you as if to say, okay, I know you want to take a picture of me, you know, because I'm purpling over everything. I'm taking pictures left and center, you know.
There's some endemic species there as well that you don't get anywhere else on Earth.
Oh, man.
So it really is all eight families of butterflies are represented there. And then, as I said, there's these endemic species as well. So it really is a butterfly wonderland. And in fact, there's another spot 160 kilometers southeast of Polokwane that is known as Malta Forest. And that is just an absolutely... It's a deep valley with these amazing forests.
Mm.
And that is an absolute butterfly wonderland. In fact, that is probably the hot spot in South Africa for butterflies. Wow. And in fact, one of the best in the world as well.
Now, you said there's eight families of butterflies. What do you mean by that?
Well, butterflies are under the family, at least under the order of insects called Lepidoptera. And Lepidoptera consists of the moths and the butterflies. And there are many, many families of moths, whilst in butterflies you've just got only eight families. Well, to my knowledge in South Africa, I'm not a butterfly specialist, but certainly in South Africa there's only eight families. There might be worldwide more families. But butterflies are usually they're all characterized by being having much larger wings.
Yes.
And then, of course, these very thin abdomens. But there's one family of one family that actually look very moth-like. So you sort of you have to know your characteristics of butterflies just to make sure that you're not making a mistake.
I do notice that they're very large, and they're, believe it or not, they're actually fairly friendly. I mean, it's weird because I kind of put it out there like, hey, could you just stop so I could get a picture of you?
Yeah. Are they?
And it did. It sat there on the ground and it, you know, opened and closed its wings. And I was just going, oh my God, they're so gorgeous. I woke up this morning and unfortunately there was this huge, beautiful moth that had died that was right in front of the door to the bathroom. And I was like, oh, I'm so sad, but I couldn't get over. This is a moth.
Does it look like almost like a large butterfly?
Yes.
Yes. That's
it,
a
it had
family.
Nothing
family Saturnidae, I think. And it's called the emperor moth. And apparently they have of the most amazing senses of smell of any animal.
A moth.
A moth, yes. And it smells with its antennae. And a male moth can pick up the scent as small as just one molecule from the female through its antennae, which would then direct it and guide it to the female.
That is amazing.
Yes, well, they really are incredible.
I know, it's such a gift to just see. You know, this is something that we just don't really get to see. I've told you this before, but when we went on a mission last summer across country, we drove about 3,000 miles. And in that 3,000 miles, we never once had to pull over and wash our windshield. Now,
yes.
This is unheard of. I mean, I don't know if any of you out there can relate to the days when, you know, if you grew up in the 60s, you know, very, very young in the 60s, if you grew up back then, you knew that you got in the car and you drove and you had to stop from time to time because there were so many flying insects that would smash up against the windshield. We never had to stop and do that on this trip. It was such an eye-opener for us to see what the chemtrails had done.
Wow.
Yeah. Now I come here, and honestly, I've been here for over a month, and I've only seen chemtrails like twice.
Wow.
And so that's a huge gift.
Yes.
And I think the chemtrails are dissipating because they have become less and less. My region of Southern California, thank God.
And it's so subtle, actually. You don't realize the effects. You just think that it's just planes giving off, it's just combustion.
Right.
It's just the after effects of combustion.
But then you talk about, you know, how you're speaking of the balance just from the little spiders and butterflies and stuff. See how important they are, you know. So even though it's like the invisible assistance, I love that, you know.
Yes.
Where have they gone? Where are they now?
Yes. Yeah, no, it's, I guess one would have to make a proper study of to see what the declines are. In that respect, there's very little work that's been done on spider populations. There is some information, there are some statistics out there, but I don't think anybody's really made a full study of it. But there was just this estimation of how many insect spiders eat per year, and I know that it's very, very significant. And also just the number of spiders that were counted in certain ecozones per square meter, so to say. Amount of spiders that the ground surface area is supporting. Now, bearing in mind that all those spiders have to eat.
Mm-hmm.
And what are they eating? They're eating insects.
Right. Which, of course, isn't there something insane like a 1,000-to-1 ratio or something?
Something to that effect.
Yeah.
Yes. No, absolutely.
Somebody needs to consume them, huh?
No, for sure.
Well, yeah. Listen, for our next part two of this interview, I really want to dive into the big five and what you guys refer to as the gaming, I don't know, the gaming what? And I don't want to call it industry.
Yes.
And your actual tours that you've gone through, because I think people are just going to be absolutely fascinated.
Yes.
So everybody stay tuned and we will have part two, coming up for you shortly.
Okay, everyone, I hope you enjoyed part one of the interview with Rupert Harris of Amberfeld Tours. And we will be bringing in part two next week. And in the meantime, please feel free to visit our daily blog page at galacticconnection.com/daily-blog. For further information on implant removals, just click the upper left-hand button on the left column, and there's a slew of information there, as well as links for testimonials and additional insights and interviews. If you have any other questions, just feel free to drop us an email at admin at galacticconnection.com. And we just appreciate your listening pleasure, and we hope that we are providing you information that can inspire and motivate and bring you to a new state of awareness that assists you in living peacefully and harmonically on this planet. If you feel compelled to donate to Galactic Connection, we would dearly appreciate it. We do basically everything complimentary, including the blogging 7 days a week. So there is a donation button at the upper right-hand corner of the Galactic Connection page. Thank you so much. I love you all, and you take care.